There are losers because there are winners. Every condition exists, Martin Luther King Jr. once wrote, simply because someone profits by its existence. This economic exploitation is crystallized in the slum. Exploitation. Now, there's a word that has been scrubbed out of the poverty debate. It is a word that speaks to the fact that poverty is not just a product of low incomes. It is also a product of extractive markets. Boosting poor people's incomes by increasing the minimum wage or public benefits, say, is absolutely crucial. But not all of those extra dollars will stay in the pockets of the poor. Wage hikes are tempered if rents rise along with them, just as food stamps are worth less if groceries in the inner city cost more. And they do, as much as 40% more by one estimate. Poverty is two-faced, a matter of income and expenses, input and output. And in a world of exploitation, it will not be effectively ameliorated if we ignore this plain fact. History testifies to this point. When the American labor movement rose up in the 1830s to demand higher wages, landed capital did not lock arms with industrial capital. Instead, landlords rooted for the workers because higher wages would allow them to collect higher rents. History repeated itself 100 years later, when wage gains that workers had made through labor strikes were quickly absorbed by rising rents. In the interwar years, the industrial job market expanded, but the housing market, especially for blacks, did not, allowing landlords to recoup workers' income gains. Today, if evictions are lowest each February, it is because many members of the city's working poor dedicate some or all of their earned income tax credit to pay back rent. In many cases, this annual benefit is as much a boost to landlords as to low-income working families. In fixating almost exclusively on what poor people and their communities lack, good jobs, a strong safety net, role models, we have neglected the critical ways that exploitation contributes to the persistence of poverty. We have overlooked a fact that landlords never have. There is a lot of money to be made off the poor. The hood is good. Exploitation thrives when it comes to the essentials, like housing and food. Most of the 12 million Americans who take out high-interest payday loans do so not to buy luxury items or cover unexpected expenses, but to pay the rent or gas bill, buy food, or meet other regular expenses. Payday loans are but one of many financial techniques, from overdraft fees to student loans for for-profit colleges, specifically designed to pull money from the pockets of the poor. If the poor pay more for their housing, food, durable goods, and credit, and if they get smaller returns on their educations and mortgages, if they get returns at all, then their incomes are even smaller than they appear. This is fundamentally unfair. Those who profit from the current situation, and those indifferent to it, will say that the housing market should be left alone to regulate itself. They don't really mean that. Exploitation within the housing market relies on government support. It is the government that legitimizes and defends landlords' right to charge as much as they want, that subsidizes the construction of high-end apartments, bidding up rents, and leaving the poor with even fewer options, that pays landlords when a family cannot, through one-time or ongoing housing assistance, that forcibly removes a family at landlord's request by dispatching armed law enforcement officers, and that records and publicizes evictions as a service to landlords and debt collection agencies. Just as the police and the prison have worked to triage the ill effects of rising joblessness in the inner city, like social unrest or the growth of the underground economy, civil courts, sheriff deputies, and homeless shelters manage the fallout of rising housing costs among the urban poor and the privatization of the low-income housing market. Landlords like to describe themselves as a special breed, but they are neither alone in making a living off the poor, nor are they so different from the rest of us. Large-scale historical and structural changes have given urban landlords the opportunity to make good money, sometimes spectacular money, by providing housing to struggling families at a cost the law has deemed fair and just. If given the same opportunity, would any of us price an apartment at half of what it could fetch, or simply forgive and forget losing thousands of dollars when the rent checks didn't arrive? Emphasizing the importance of exploitation does not mean haranguing landlords as greedy or heartless. It means uncovering the ironies and inefficiencies that arise when policymakers try to help poor families without addressing the root causes of their poverty. It means trying to understand landlords' and tenants' acceptance of extreme inequality. And our own. Regardless of how landlords came to own property, sweat, intelligence, or ingenuity for some, inheritance, luck, or fraud for others. Rising rents mean more money for landlords and less for tenants. Their fates are bound, and their interests opposed. If the profits of urban landlords were modest, that would be one thing, but often they are not. The annual income of the landlord of perhaps the worst trailer park in the fourth poorest city in America is 30 times that of his tenants working full-time for minimum wage and 55 times the annual income of his tenants receiving welfare or SSI. There are two freedoms at odds with each other: the freedom to profit from rents and the freedom to live in a safe and affordable home. There is a way we can rebalance these two freedoms: by significantly expanding our housing voucher program so that all low-income families could benefit from it. What we need most is a housing program for the unlucky majority, the millions of poor families struggling unassisted in the private market, that promotes the values most of us support: security, fairness, and equal opportunity. A universal housing voucher program would carve a middle path between the landlord's desire to make a living and the tenant's desire, simply, to live. The idea is simple. Every family below a certain income level would be eligible for a housing voucher. They could use that voucher to live anywhere they wanted, just as families can use food stamps to buy groceries virtually anywhere, as long as their housing was neither too expensive, big and luxurious, nor too shabby and run down. Their home would need to be decent, modest, and fairly priced. Program administrators could develop fine-grained analyses, borrowing from algorithms and other tools commonly used in the private market, to prevent landlords from charging too much and families from selecting more housing than they need. The family would dedicate 30% of their income to housing costs, with the voucher paying the rest. A universal voucher program would change the face of poverty in this country. Evictions would plummet and become rare occurrences. Homelessness would almost disappear. Families would immediately feel the income gains and be able to buy enough food, invest in themselves and their children through schooling or job training, and start modest savings. They would find stability and have a sense of ownership over their home and community. Universal housing programs have been successfully implemented all over the developed world. In countries that have such programs, every single family with an income below a certain level who meets basic program requirements has a right to housing assistance. Great Britain's housing benefit is available to so many households that a journalist recently reporting on the program asked, "Perhaps it is easier to say who does not get it." "Indeed," came the answer. This benefit, transferred directly to landlords in most cases, ensures that paying rent does not plunge a family into poverty. The Netherlands Housing Allowance operates in a similar way and helps provide good homes to nearly one-third of all its tenants. It has been remarkably successful at housing the country's poorest citizens. There is a reason why these countries have come to rely on vouchers. Although vouchers are not everywhere the most efficient option, particularly in expensive cities, they are the best way to deliver a national program. In theory, you could solve the problem by expanding public housing, tax credits, homeownership initiatives, or developer incentives. But each of these options quickly confronts the problem of scale. Vouchers are far more cost-effective than new construction, whether in the form of public housing or subsidized private development. We can't build our way out. Given mounting regulatory and construction costs, offering each low-income family the opportunity to live in public housing would be prohibitively expensive. Even if it weren't, building that much public housing risks repeating the failures of the past by drawing the nation's poorest citizens under the same roof and contributing to racial segregation and concentrated poverty. Would a universal housing program be a disincentive to work? It is a fair and important question. One study has shown that housing assistance leads to a modest reduction in work hours and earnings, but others have found no effect. In truth, the status quo is much more of a threat to self-sufficiency than any housing program could be. Families crushed by the high cost of housing cannot afford vocational training or extra schooling that would allow them to acquire new skills, and many cannot stay in one place long enough to hold down the same job. Affordable housing is a human capital investment, just like job programs or education, one that would strengthen and steady the American workforce. By and large, the poor do not want some small life. They don't want to game the system or eke out an existence. They want to thrive and contribute, to become nurses, that was Vanetta's dream, or run their own charities, that was Arlene's. A stable home would extend to them the opportunity to realize those dreams. Landlords in most states are not obligated to accept families with housing vouchers, and many don't because they shun extra building code mandates or the administrative hassle. A universal voucher program would take their concerns seriously. Some building codes are critical to maintaining safe and decent housing. Others are far less so. Enforcing a strict building code in apartments where voucher holders live can be an unnecessary burden on landlords and drive up costs. But even if code enforcement and program administration were made much more reasonable and landlord-friendly, some property owners, particularly those operating in prosperous areas, would still turn away voucher holders. They simply don't want to house those people. If we continue to permit this kind of discrimination, we consign voucher holders to certain landlords who own property in certain neighborhoods. Doing so denies low-income families the opportunity to move into economically healthy and safe neighborhoods and hobbles our ability to promote integration through social policy. Accordingly, a universal voucher program would not only strive to make participation attractive to landlords, it would also mandate participation. Just as we have outlawed discrimination on the basis of race or religion, discrimination against voucher holders would be illegal under a universal voucher program. A well-designed program would ensure a reasonable rent that rose at the rate of inflation and include flexible provisions allowing landlords to receive a modest rate of return. It would also provide them with steadier rental income, less turnover, and fewer evictions. If we are going to house most low-income families in the private rental market, then that market must remain profitable. The business of housing the poor, Jacob Riis wrote 125 years ago, if it is to amount to anything, must be a business, as it was business with our fathers to put them where they are. As charity, pastime, or fad, it will miserably fail, always and everywhere. And yet, housing is too fundamental a human need, too central to children's health and development, too important to expanding economic opportunities and stabilizing communities to be treated as simply a business, a crude investment vehicle, something that just cashes out. Making a universal housing program as efficient as possible would require regulating costs. Expanding housing vouchers without stabilizing rent would be asking taxpayers to subsidize landlords' profits. Today, landlords overcharge voucher holders simply because they can. In distressed neighborhoods where voucher holders tend to live, market rent is lower than what landlords are allowed to charge voucher holders, according to metropolitan-wide rent ceilings set by program administrators. So the Housing Choice Voucher Program likely costs not millions, but billions of dollars more than it should, resulting in the unnecessary denial of help to hundreds of thousands of families. In fact, economists have argued that the current housing voucher program could be expanded to serve all poor families in America without additional spending if we prevented overcharging and made the program more efficient. Even if we did nothing to make the voucher program more cost-effective, we still could afford to offer this crucial benefit to all low-income families in America. In 2013, the Bipartisan Policy Center estimated that expanding housing vouchers to all renting families below the 30th percentile in median income for their area would require an additional $22.5 billion, increasing total spending on housing assistance to around $60 billion. The figure is likely much less, as the estimate does not account for potential savings the expanded program would bring in the form of preventing homelessness, reducing health care costs, and curbing other costly consequences of the affordable housing crisis. It is not a small figure, but it is well within our capacity. We have the money. We've just made choices about how to spend it. Over the years, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have restricted housing aid to the poor, but expanded it to the affluent in the form of tax benefits for homeowners. Today, housing-related tax expenditures far outpace those for housing assistance. In 2008, the year Arlene was evicted from 13th Street, federal expenditures for direct housing assistance totaled less than $40.2 billion, but homeowner tax benefits exceeded $171 billion. That number, $171 billion, was equivalent to the 2008 budgets for the Department of Education, the Department of Veterans Affairs, the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Agriculture combined. Each year, we spend three times what a universal housing voucher program is estimated to cost, in total, on homeowner benefits, like the mortgage interest deduction and the capital gains exclusion. Most federal housing subsidies benefit families with six-figure incomes. If we are going to spend the bulk of our public dollars on the affluent, at least when it comes to housing, we should own up to that decision and stop repeating the politician's canard about one of the richest countries on the planet being unable to afford doing more. If poverty persists in America, it is not for lack of resources. A universal voucher program is but one potential policy recommendation. Let others come. Establishing the basic right to housing in America could be realized in any number of ways, and probably should be. What works best in New York might fail in Los Angeles. The solution to housing problems in booming Houston or Atlanta or Seattle is not what is most needed in the deserted metropolises of the Rust Belt, or Florida's impoverished suburbs or small towns dotting the landscape. One city must build, another must destroy. If our cities and towns are rich in diversity, with unique textures and styles, gifts and problems, so too must be our solutions. Whatever our way out of this mess, one thing is certain. This degree of inequality, this withdrawal of opportunity, this cold denial of basic needs, this endorsement of pointless suffering, by no American value is this situation justified. No moral code or ethical principle, no piece of scripture or holy teaching can be summoned to defend what we have allowed our country to become. About this project. When I was growing up, my father was a preacher, and my industrious mother worked everywhere. Money was always tight. Sometimes the gas got shut off, and Mom cooked dinner on top of our wood-burning stove. She knew how to make do, having grown up across from a junkyard in Columbus, Georgia, and later in San Francisco's infamous Ford Hotel. She had done better for herself and expected us kids to do the same, to go off to college even if she and my father weren't able to help pay for it. My father drilled this point home in his own way. Whenever we drove past a line of bent-over people sweating in the sun for some lousy job, my father would turn to us and ask, "Do you want to do that for the rest of your life?" "No." "Then go to college." Thanks to some loans and scholarships, I was able to attend Arizona State University, a 4-hour drive from my hometown of Winslow. I thought I might want to be a lawyer, so I enrolled in courses on communication, history, and justice. In those classes, I began learning things that did not square with the image of America passed down to me from my parents, Sunday school teachers, and Boy Scout troop leaders. Was the depth and expanse of poverty in this country truly unmatched in the developed world? Was the American dream widely attainable or reserved for a privileged few? When I wasn't working or studying, I was thumbing through books in the library seeking answers about the character of my country. It was around that time that the bank took my childhood home. A friend and I made the 4-hour drive and helped my parents move. I remember being deeply sad and embarrassed. I didn't know how to make sense of it, but maybe something worked its way inside because once back on campus, I found myself spending weekends helping my girlfriend build houses with Habitat for Humanity. Then I began hanging out with homeless people around Tempe's Mill Avenue several nights a week. The people I met living on the street were young and old, funny, genuine, and troubled. When I graduated, I felt a need to understand poverty in America, which I saw as the wellspring of so many miseries. I figured sociology would be the best place to do that. So I enrolled in a PhD program at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, a town that grizzled Milwaukeeans refer to as 30 square miles surrounded by reality. When I began studying poverty as a graduate student, I learned that most accounts explained inequality in one of two ways. The first referenced structural forces, seemingly beyond our control. Historical legacies of discrimination, say, or massive transformations of the economy. The second emphasized individual deficiencies, from cultural practices, like starting a family outside of wedlock, to human capital shortfalls, like low levels of education. Liberals preferred the first explanation, and conservatives the second. To me, both seemed off. Each treated low-income families as if they lived in quarantine. With books about single mothers, gang members, or the homeless, social scientists and journalists were writing about poor people as if they were cut off from the rest of society. The poor were said to be invisible or part of the other America. The ghetto was treated like a city within a city. The poor were being left out of the inequality debate, as if we believed the livelihoods of the rich and the middle class were intertwined, but those of the poor and everyone else were not. Where were the rich people who wielded enormous influence over the lives of low-income families in their communities, who were rich precisely because they did so? Why, I wondered, have we documented how the poor make ends meet without asking why their bills are so high or where their money is flowing? I wanted to try to write a book about poverty that didn't focus exclusively on poor people or poor places. Poverty was a relationship, I thought, involving poor and rich people alike. To understand poverty, I needed to understand that relationship. This set me searching for a process that bound poor and rich people together in mutual dependence and struggle. Eviction was such a process. I moved into Tobin's trailer park in May 2008, after reading in the newspaper that its residents could face mass eviction. That didn't happen. Tobin eventually did sell the trailer park, and Lenny and Office Susie moved elsewhere. But I stayed anyway because the park proved a fine place to meet people getting the pink papers. It also allowed me to spend time with Tobin and Lenny. My trailer was considered to be one of the nicest in the park. It was clean, with wood paneling and thick, rust-orange carpet. But for most of the 4 months I lived in it, I did not have hot water because, despite multiple requests, Tobin and Lenny neglected to fix the chimney to my water heater. They just didn't get around to it, even though I told them I was a writer working on a book about them and their trailer park. If used, the water heater would have emitted carbon monoxide straight into the trailer. Office Susie tried to fix it once. She jammed a wooden board underneath and, with 2 inches still separating the water heater from the chimney, pronounced it safe. To me, ethnography is what you do when you try to understand people by allowing their lives to mold your own as fully and genuinely as possible. You do this by building rapport with the people you want to know better and following them over a long stretch of time, observing and experiencing what they do, working and playing alongside them, and recording as much action and interaction as you can until you begin to move like they move, talk like they talk, think like they think, and feel something like they feel. In this line of work, living in the field helps quite a lot. It's the only way to have an immersive experience, and practically speaking, you never know when important things are going to happen. Renting a trailer allowed me to meet dozens of people, pick up on rumors, absorb tenants' concerns and perspectives, and observe everyday life all hours of the day. I began my field work in the trailer park, hanging out in the office where some of my neighbors spent most of their days. I was in the office the evening Lorraine walked in, shaking and gripping a warning from the sheriff's eviction squad. I watched her pay Tobin what she could before dragging herself back to her trailer. I followed her there. Lorraine opened the door, wiping away tears with the bottom of her shirt. That's how we met. After word spread that I was interested in talking to people going through an eviction, Pam got a hold of my phone number and called me up. A few days after we met, I began trailing her and her family as they looked for a new place to live. Pam told Scott about my project, and he told me to stop by his trailer. When I did one morning, Scott stepped outside and said, "Let's walk." Then he said, "Well, let's just get this out in the open. I was a nurse for years, but then I got addicted to painkillers and lost everything. My job, my car, my house. No one really knows why some people unfurl like this in front of a stranger with a notepad and pen, why they open the door and let you in. With tenants on the verge of homelessness, there were material benefits like access to a car and phone, and psychological ones too. Several called me their shrink. But there is another truth too, which is that some people at the bottom don't think they have anything left to lose. One evening at the Aldea Recovery House, where Scott had been living sober for a few months, Scott nodded to me, scribbling away in my notepad, and asked AA diehard Anna Aldea, "Does it make you nervous, having Matt here?" "Fuck no," Anna said. "My life is an open book." Said Scott, "I'm the same way. You know, I've got no pride or anything left." When fall arrived, having seen Scott, Lorraine, and Pam and Ned evicted from the trailer park, I began looking for a new place to live on the north side. One day, I mentioned this to Officer Wu, one of the security guards Tobin had been forced to hire to appease Alderman Witkowski. Wu's real name was Kimball, but he told everyone to call him by his childhood nickname. A gregarious black man who tried to make friends with everyone in the park, he wore size 6XL t-shirts and a security badge he had picked up at an army surplus shop. "You talking about moving out by Silver Spring?" Wu asked, thinking about an area where Milwaukee's black inner city gave way to the northern suburbs of Glendale and Brown Deer. "I'm thinking like city center," I clarified. "You want to be by Marquette?" Wu asked again, referencing the Jesuit University located downtown. "Not by Marquette. I'm looking for an inner city neighborhood." Wu squinted at me, assuming he had misunderstood. It took a few more conversations for Wu to realize that I wanted to live on the north side, in a neighborhood like his, where the street signs were green, not blue, like in the suburb of Wauwatosa. Once he did, Wu invited me to live with him in a rooming house on First and Locust. The rent was $400, utilities included. I accepted and paid the landlords, Sharina and Quentin. The rooming house was on the second floor of a duplex, white with green trim. Wu and I shared a living room, bathroom, and kitchen, whose cupboards could be padlocked to keep your roommates from eating your food. My room came with a window, draped with a heavy blanket, and a full-size bed, under which I found an empty can of Classic Ice, Narcotics Anonymous pamphlets, toenail clippers, and a typewriter in a hard plastic case. Behind the rooming house was an alley, tagged in rushed gangster disciples graffiti, and a small, weedy backyard with a cherry tree that, come May, unveiled soft blossoms that looked like a spray of confetti. I lived in the rooming house until June 2009. Wu had told Sharina that I was working on a book about landlords and tenants. Sharina agreed to an interview, at the end of which I made my pitch. "Sharina, I would love to be kind of like your apprentice," I said, explaining that my goal was to walk in her shoes as closely as possible. Sharina was all in. "I'm committed to this," she said. "You have your person." She was in love with her work and proud of it, too. She wanted people to know what landlords had to go through, to share her world with a wider public that rarely stopped to consider it. I began shadowing Sharina and Quentin as they bought property, screened tenants, unclogged sewer pipes, and delivered eviction notices, just as I had done with Tobin and Lenny. I met Arlene, Lamar, and the Hingston clan through Sharina. Later, I met Crystal through Arlene, and Vanetta through Crystal. Doreen was lonely and happy to have someone to sit and talk with. Lamar warmed to me after I helped him paint Patrice's old unit. I later sealed the deal by being decent at spades, which I used to play regularly during my days working as a firefighter in college. Arlene was a much tougher case. At first, she kept me at a distance and would remain silent when I explained my project to her. When I tried to fill the silence, she would cut me off, saying, "You don't need to keep talking." Her biggest worry was that I worked for Child Protective Services. "I feel uncomfortable talking with you," Arlene told me during one of our early conversations. "Not because of how you are, but just because of all this stuff that's happened to me. I've been in the child welfare system so long that I just don't trust people anymore." I responded by saying that I understood, giving her some of my published work, which I learned to keep in my car for moments like this, and later, taking it very slowly, limiting myself to only a handful of questions per meeting. Other people thought I was a police officer or, in the trailer park, a spy for the alderman. Still others thought I was a drug addict or a John. For a time, Wu and I lived with sex workers in the rooming house. Sharina introduced me as her assistant. To Tobin, I was nobody. Some tenants suspected I was in cahoots with their landlord, whom they referred to as your friend. On several occasions, they tried to get me to admit to their landlord's wrongdoing, like the time Lamar pressured me to admit Sharina was a slumlord. When I refused, Lamar accused me of being her snoop. Some landlords refused to discuss the details of a tenant's case or, in the opposite direction, asked me to weigh in on a specific case. My policy was to intervene as little as possible, although, as I described below, I abandoned that policy on two occasions. But landlords often forced my hand. To my knowledge, the only time I had any real effect on a case was the time Sharina asked me repeatedly if she should call the sheriff on Arlene. I finally said no, and she didn't. Sharina later told me, "Had you not been involved, honestly, truly, I would have done the writ and been waiting on the sheriff. If you didn't intervene, she would have been dead meat." So instead of Eagle Moving taking her things, Arlene got to store them in public storage until they were trashed for missed payments. After a while, both tenants and landlords began to accept me and get on with their lives. They had more important things to worry about. I sat beside tenants at eviction court, helped them move, followed them into shelters and abandoned houses, watched their children, fought with them, and slept at their houses. I attended church with them, as well as counseling sessions, AA meetings, funerals, and births. I followed one family to Texas. I visited Iowa with Scott. As I spent more time with people, something like trust emerged, even if it remained a fragile, heavily qualified trust. Years after meeting, Arlene would still ask me, during a quiet moment, if I worked for Child Protective Services. If moving to the north side initially confused Wu, it deeply disturbed my neighbors in the trailer park. When I told Lorraine, she nearly cried, "No, Matt, you don't know how dangerous it is." Beaker chimed in, "They don't cotton to white folks over there." But the truth is that white people are afforded special privileges in the ghetto. For one, my interactions with the police were non-intrusive and quick, even after a pair of separate shootings happened outside my front door. Once, I watched a police officer pull his patrol car up to Jer-Jer, Arlene's eldest son, and say, "Man, you're fucked up." Jer-Jer had a learning disability that caused him to move and talk slowly. When I came out of the apartment for a closer look, the officer looked at me and drove away. He might have acted differently had I not been a white man with a notepad. There were other moments like this. Take Crystal and Vanetta's exchange with the discriminating landlord on 15th Street. When that went down, I was outside in the car watching Vanetta's kids. The women told me about it when they returned, immediately afterward. I copied down the landlord's number from the rent sign and called him up the next day. Meeting him in the same unit Vanetta and Crystal had been shown, I told him I took home about $1,400 a month, Vanetta and Crystal's combined income, that I had three kids, like Vanetta, and that I'd really like a unit with a bathtub. The landlord told me that he had another unit available. He even drove me to it in his Saab. I reported him to the Fair Housing Council. They took down my report and never called me back. Inner city residents took care to protect me and make sure I wasn't taken advantage of, as when Lamar would snap at his boys, "Cut that shit out," when they asked me for a dollar. One day at the rooming house, Cece, one of my downstairs neighbors, asked to borrow a few dollars so she could buy trash bags. I obliged and went back to writing, but Keisha, Wu's young niece who was living with us at the time, kept an eye on Cece as she left and claimed to see her call her dope man. Oblivious to this, I soon headed out for the store. When Wu got home, Keisha told him about the exchange, and he called me, angry. "Matt, you don't ever give her nothing," he said. "They think because you're not like us, because you're not from around here, that they can just come at you like that. I'm about to go down there and tell them to give you your fucking money back." "Well, Wu, look, Matt." Wu hung up. I don't know exactly what he said to Cece, but when I got home, she met me outside, wearing a wig, cut-off shorts, a revealing halter top, and strappy heels. Cece handed me the money. I didn't ask how she got it. It felt terrible. "You're too protective of me," I told Wu when I got upstairs. He was leaning over the kitchen sink, washing dishes, shirtless. "You suburbs, we hood," he began, using his low father-to-son voice he reserved for moments like this. "And you came down here, took a chance living in the hood with me, and that was a real honor for me, and I feel responsible for you here. I ain't let nothing happen to you." A white person living in and writing about the inner city is not uniquely exposed to threats, but uniquely shielded from them. And inner city residents sometimes stiffened in my presence. People often started cleaning up and apologizing after meeting me for the first time. In my late 20s, I was called sir countless more times than I was told by some young tough to get a G-pass, a gangster pass, essentially to account for my white self. These are non-trivial issues for someone trying to record life as it is actually lived. The only thing to do is to spend as much time on the ground as you can, transforming yourself from novelty to perpetual foreigner. People generally relax and go about their business with enough time, even if their guard can fly up again in certain circumstances. It takes time, too, to be taught how to notice things by people like Keisha, who have learned when to listen and what to look for. The people I met in Milwaukee trained my vision by modeling how to see and showing me how to make sense of what I saw. Still, I know I missed a lot, especially in the beginning, not only because I was an outsider, but also because I was constantly overanalyzing things. A buzzing inner monologue would often draw me inward, hindering my ability to remain alert to the heat of life at play right in front of me. It's safer that way. Our ideas allow us to tame social life, to order it according to typologies and theories. As Susan Sontag has warned, this comfort can deplete the world and get in the way of seeing. Researching this book involved spending long stretches of time with women, often in their homes, which raised suspicions. In two incidents, men accused me of sleeping with their girlfriends. The first occurred during a drunken argument between Ned and Pam, when Ned snapped, "You're the one talking to Matt like he's a fucking psychologist. Why don't you go fuck him?" After Ned stormed off, Pam said to me, "He thinks we're fucking. How pathetic is that?" The fight died down, and Ned backed off from the accusation. But several weeks after that happened, I kept my distance from Pam and tried spending as much time with Ned as I could. On another occasion, I stopped by to see Vanetta the month before she was sentenced to prison and found her with Earl, an older man she had met at the lodge. Earl had taken a strong romantic interest in Vanetta, an interest she entertained, and he was not happy to see me. Said Earl, "You see, this is my woman, and I should know what my woman is doing." I took my time explaining my job to Earl and showed him my previous work. I thought he was capable of hurting Vanetta. His rap sheet contained domestic abuse charges, or at least of leaving her and taking his VA check with him. Earl eventually apologized to me, but the exchange was deeply unsettling. When I left, I asked Vanetta's sister, Ebony, to check on Vanetta, which she did. And the next morning, I called to make sure everything was okay. "He don't scare me, though," Vanetta told me. He should have. After Vanetta got out of prison and broke it off with Earl, someone shot up Ebony's apartment, where Vanetta and her children were staying. Everyone suspected Earl. I've always felt that my first duty as an ethnographer was to make sure my work did not harm those who invited me into their lives. But this can be a complicated and delicate matter because it is not always obvious at first what does harm. Especially in poor neighborhoods, nothing is free. People get compensated for favors one way or another. Ned and Earl figured that if I was giving their girlfriends rides as they looked for housing and went about their business, I must be getting something in return. I was, of course. Stories. That was the strange thing. Their accusations were perfectly valid, and I took them seriously. Gender influenced how people behaved and talked in my presence in other ways, too. After prison, Vanetta found a job running tables at a George Webb restaurant and met a new man, Ben, who aspired to be a truck driver. One night, in their apartment, Ben left abruptly. "Are you guys okay?" I asked. "Not really," Vanetta sighed. "He thinks I act too much like a man." "What's that mean?" I asked. "It's like I know too much. He's always like, you acting like a man, like you always have to have an answer to everything." "You ever pretend not to know stuff?" "Sometimes." Right then, I wondered how often Vanetta had played dumb with me, how often she had faked ignorance to appear more ladylike. Everything about you, your race and gender, where and how you were raised, your temperament and disposition, can influence whom you meet, what is confided to you, what you are shown, and how you interpret what you see. My identity opened some doors and closed others. In the end, we can only do the best we can with who we are, paying close attention to the ways pieces of ourselves matter to the work, while never losing sight of the most important questions. While living in Milwaukee, I was a full-time field worker. Most days, I carried a digital recorder and just let it run. This allowed me to capture people's words verbatim. I also carried a small notepad and wrote down observations and conversations, usually as they were happening. I never hid the fact that I was a writer trying to record as much as I could. In the evenings and early mornings, I would spend hours typing up the jottings from my notebooks and writing about the day's events. I took thousands of photographs. I conducted more than 100 interviews with people not featured in this book, including 30 landlords. I spoke with and observed court officers, social workers, building inspectors, property managers, and other people who lived in the trailer park or inner city. When I left the field, I began a long process of transcribing the recorded material. Some people helped me with this, but I did a significant amount myself. After everything was down on paper, my notes spanned over 5,000 single-spaced pages. I began poring over the words, calling up the photographs, and listening to recordings on my way to work or when rocking my newborn to sleep. I read and reread everything several times before I felt ready to begin writing. I wanted to be as close to the material as possible, to experience a kind of second immersion in the words and scenes. And I missed everyone. Moving from the north side of Milwaukee to Cambridge, Massachusetts, a rich, rarefied community, was profoundly disorienting. At first, all I wanted was to be back in the trailer park or the inner city. I returned as often as I could. Writing this book, I have prioritized first-hand observation. When something important happened that I didn't see, I spoke to multiple people about the event whenever possible and checked details by drawing on other sources, such as news reports, medical or court records, and mortgage files. I have indicated in the notes all events sourced from second-hand accounts. I said that someone thought or believed something only when they said as much to me. When writing about things that happened in people's past, I said someone remembered or recalled it a certain way. To interrogate those details, I would ask the same person the same questions multiple times over several years. This proved to be incredibly useful, as some things people told me at the beginning turned out to be inaccurate. Sometimes, the truth comes out slow. As much as possible, I vetted the material in this book by reaching out to third parties. Often, this meant confirming the possibility of something happening, if not the thing itself. For example, I was able to verify with the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families that the welfare sanctions Arlene experienced were not uncommon. I had overheard Arlene explain the sanctions to Sharina and had accompanied Arlene as she met with a caseworker to sort out the details. But because this was something I could corroborate with a few emails and phone calls, I did. After all, eyewitnessing is a fraught and imperfect thing, as any defense attorney will tell you. Things hide in plain sight and misdirection is everywhere. I dropped stories that could not be verified through this method. Once, Natasha Hingston told me that she stopped going to high school after there was a shooting in her cafeteria. After confirming this story with Doreen, I found myself drawn to it, eager to include it somewhere, which is an impulse I've learned to mistrust. So I spoke with three separate Milwaukee public school administrators, none of whom could confirm that a shooting occurred around the time Natasha said it did. Perhaps something did happen and the administrators were wrong. Perhaps the gist, if not the details, of Natasha's story was true. Perhaps not. Whatever the case, I excluded this account and two others that could not be corroborated in this manner. Once the book was fully drafted, I hired an independent fact checker. I also traveled to Milwaukee and Brownsville, Tennessee, to tie up loose ends. I am frequently asked how I handled this research, by which people mean, how did seeing this level of poverty and suffering affect you personally? I don't think people realize how raw and intimate a question this is. So I've developed several dishonest responses, which I drop like those smoke bombs magicians use when they want to glide off stage unseen. The honest answer is that the work was heartbreaking and left me depressed for years. You do learn how to cope from those who are coping. After several people told me, "Stop looking at me like that," I learned to suppress my shock at traumatic things. I learned to tell a real crisis from mere poverty. I learned that behavior that looks lazy or withdrawn to someone perched far above the poverty line can actually be a pacing technique. People like Crystal or Lorraine cannot afford to give all their energy to today's emergency, only to have none left over for tomorrow's. I saw in the trailer park and inner city resilience and spunk and brilliance. I heard a lot of laughter, but I also saw a lot of pain. Toward the end of my fieldwork, I wrote in my journal, "I feel dirty collecting these stories and hardships like so many trophies." The guilt I felt during my fieldwork only intensified after I left. I felt like a phony and like a traitor, ready to confess to some unnamed accusation. I couldn't help but translate a bottle of wine placed in front of me at a university function or my monthly daycare bill into rent payments or bail money back in Milwaukee. It leaves an impression, this kind of work. Now imagine it's your life. As I spent more time with tenants and landlords, I found myself needing answers to basic questions that were beyond the reach of my fieldwork. How prominent is eviction? What are its consequences? Who gets evicted? If poor families are spending so much on housing, what are they going without? So I went looking for studies that answered these questions. Urban poverty, community, slums, these topics had been foundational to American sociology from the beginning. Surely someone had looked into it. But I found no study and no readily available data that adequately addressed my questions. This was strange, especially given what I was seeing every day in Milwaukee. I wondered how we in the research community could have overlooked something so fundamental to poverty in America, the dynamics of the private housing market. The answer, I would later come to realize, was in the way we had been studying housing. By and large, poverty researchers had focused narrowly on public housing or other housing policies. Either that, or they had overlooked housing because they were more interested in the character of urban neighborhoods, their levels of residential segregation or resistance to gentrification, for example. And yet, here was the private rental market, where the vast majority of poor people lived, playing such an imposing and vital role in the lives of the families I knew in Milwaukee, consuming most of their income, aggravating their poverty and deprivation, resulting in their eviction, insecurity, and homelessness, dictating where they lived and whom they lived with, and powerfully influencing the character and stability of their neighborhoods. And we hardly knew a thing about it. I tried to ignore this problem, wanting to spend all my time with landlords and tenants on the ground. But when my questions didn't go away, I set out to gather the data myself. I began by designing a survey of tenants in Milwaukee's private housing sector. The survey began small, but with the support of the MacArthur Foundation, it grew into something more. I called it the Milwaukee Area Renter Study, MARS for short. From 2009 to 2011, roughly 1,100 tenants were interviewed in their homes by professional interviewers trained and supervised by the University of Wisconsin Survey Center, which reported to me. To facilitate estimates generalizable to Milwaukee's entire rental population, households from across the city were interviewed. Clipboards and portable Lenovo ThinkPad computers in hand, interviewers ventured into some of the city's worst neighborhoods. One was bitten by a dog, and later, mugged. Thanks to the heroic efforts of the Survey Center, MARS had an extraordinarily high response rate for a survey of such a highly mobile and poor population, 84%. What I was learning during my fieldwork deeply informed MARS's 250 questions, not only what I asked, but how I asked it. For example, when I was living in the trailer park, I learned that asking why someone moved was no simple task. Tenants often provided an explanation for a move that maximized their own volition. And asking about involuntary mobility, for its part, came with its own set of complications, as tenants tended to have strict conceptions of eviction. Take Rose and Tim, my neighbors in the trailer park. Rose and Tim were forced to leave their trailer after Tim sustained a back injury at work. They did not go to court, but undeniably were evicted. Their names appear in the eviction records. Nevertheless, they didn't see things this way. "When you say eviction," Rose explained, "I think of the sheriffs coming and throwing you out and changing your locks, and Eagle Movers tosses your stuff on the curb. That's an eviction. We were not evicted." If Rose and Tim had been asked during a survey, "Have you ever been evicted?" they would have answered no. Accordingly, surveys that have posed this question vastly underestimate the prevalence of involuntary removal from housing. I learned to ask the question differently in light of tenants' understanding of the matter and designed the survey accordingly. Mars collected new data on housing, residential mobility, eviction, and urban poverty. These data provide the only comprehensive estimate of the frequency of involuntary displacement from housing among urban renters. When I ran the numbers, I was shocked to discover that 1 in 8 Milwaukee renters experienced at least one forced move, formal or informal eviction, landlord foreclosure, or building condemnation in the 2 years prior to being surveyed. The survey also showed that nearly half of those forced moves, 48%, were informal evictions. Off-the-books displacements, not processed through the court, as when a landlord pays you to leave or hires a couple of heavies to throw you out. Formal eviction was less common, constituting 24% of forced moves. An additional 23% of forced moves were due to landlord foreclosure, with building condemnations accounting for the remaining 5%. In other words, for every eviction executed through the judicial system, there are two others executed beyond the purview of the court, without any form of due process. This means that estimates that do not account for informal evictions downplay the crisis in our cities. If public attention and resources are a product of how widespread policymakers think a problem is, then studies that produce artificially low eviction rates are not just wrong, they're harmful. Some of the most important findings to come out of the Milwaukee Area Renters Study have to do with evictions fallout. The data linked eviction to heightened residential instability, substandard housing, declines in neighborhood quality, and even job loss. These findings led me to analyze the consequences of eviction in a national representative data set, the Fragile Families and Child Well-Being Study, which showed that evicted mothers suffer from increased material hardship as well as poor physical and mental health. The prevalence of informal eviction notwithstanding, you can still learn something from eviction court records. They provide an accurate measure of the frequency and location of formal evictions in the city. So, I extracted records for all eviction cases that took place in Milwaukee between 2003 and 2013. Hundreds of thousands of them. According to these official records, each year almost half of all formal court-ordered evictions in Milwaukee take place in predominantly black neighborhoods. Within those neighborhoods, women are more than twice as likely to be evicted as men. Last, I designed another survey that would help me understand why certain people escaped eviction while others did not. The Milwaukee Eviction Court Study was an in-person survey of 250 tenants appearing in eviction court over a 6-week period in January and February 2011. 66% response rate. These interviews, conducted immediately after tenants' court hearings, provided a snapshot into Milwaukee's evicted population. The data show that the median age of a tenant in Milwaukee's eviction court was 33. The youngest was 19, the oldest, 69. The median monthly household income of tenants in eviction court was $935, and the median amount of back rent owed was about that much. The eviction court survey also showed that much more than rental debt separates the evicted from the almost evicted. When I analyzed these data, I found that even after accounting for how much the tenant owed the landlord and other factors like household income and race, the presence of children in the household almost tripled a tenant's odds of receiving an eviction judgment. The effect of living with children on receiving an eviction judgment was equivalent to falling 4 months behind in rent. The multiple methods and different data sources used in this book informed one another in important ways. I began this project with a set of questions to pursue, but lines of inquiry flexed and waned as my fieldwork progressed. Some would not have sprung to mind had I never set foot in the field. but it was only after analyzing court records and survey data that I was able to see the bigger picture, grasping the magnitude of eviction in poor neighborhoods, identifying disparities, and cataloging consequences of displacement. My quantitative endeavors also allowed me to assess how representative my observations were. Whenever possible, I subjected my ground-level observations to a kind of statistical check, which determined whether what I was seeing on the ground was also detectable within a larger population. When an idea was clarified or refined by aggregate comparisons, I would return to my field notes to identify the mechanisms behind the numbers. Working in concert with one another, each method enriched the others, and each kept the others honest. In addition to the larger endeavors, conducting original surveys and analyzing big data from court records, I also sought out a wide variety of evidence to bolster the validity of my observations and deepen my understanding of the issues. I analyzed 2 years' worth of nuisance property citations from the Milwaukee Police Department, obtained records of more than 1 million 911 calls in Milwaukee, and collected rent rolls, legal transcripts, public property records, school files, and psychological evaluations. Together, these combined data sources provide a new portrait of the powerful ways the private housing sector is shaping the lives of poor American families and their communities. They have shown that problems endemic to poverty, residential instability, severe deprivation, concentrated neighborhood disadvantage, health disparities, even joblessness, stem from the lack of affordable housing in our cities. I have made all survey data publicly available through the Harvard Dataverse Network. This book is based in Milwaukee. Wisconsin's largest city is not every city, but it is considerably less unique than the small clutch of iconic but exceptional places that have come to represent the American urban experience. Every city creates its own ecosystem, but in some cities, this is much more pronounced. Milwaukee is a fairly typical mid-sized metropolitan area with a fairly typical socioeconomic profile and housing market and fairly typical renter protections. It is far better suited to represent the experiences of city dwellers living in Indianapolis, Minneapolis, Baltimore, St. Louis, Cincinnati, Gary, Raleigh, Utica, and other cities left out of the national conversation because they are not America's biggest successes, San Francisco, New York City, or biggest failures, Detroit, Newark. That said, it is ultimately up to future researchers to determine whether what I found in Milwaukee is true in other places. 1,000 questions remain unanswered. We need a robust sociology of housing that reaches beyond a narrow focus on policy and public housing. We need a new sociology of displacement that documents the prevalence, causes, and consequences of eviction. And perhaps most important, we need a committed sociology of inequality that includes a serious study of exploitation and extractive markets. Still, I wonder sometimes what we are asking when we ask if findings apply elsewhere. Is it that we really believe that something could happen in Pittsburgh, but never in Albuquerque? In Memphis, but never in Dubuque? The weight of the evidence is in the other direction, especially when it comes to problems as big and as widespread as urban poverty and unaffordable housing. This study took place in the heart of a major American city, not in an isolated Polish village or a Brambley, Montana town or on the moon. The number of evictions in Milwaukee is equivalent to the number in other cities, and the people summoned to housing court in Milwaukee look a lot like those summoned in Charleston and Brooklyn. Maybe what we are really asking when we ask if a study is generalizable is, can it really be this bad everywhere? Or maybe we're asking, do I really have to pay attention to this problem? Ethnography recently has come to be written almost exclusively in the first person. It is a straightforward way of writing and an effective one. If ethnographers want people to take what they say seriously, the cultural anthropologist Clifford Geertz once observed, they have to convince readers that they have been there. And that, Geertz said, persuading us that this offstage miracle has occurred, is where the writing comes in. The first person has become the chosen mule for this task. I was there. I saw it happen. And because I saw it happen, you can believe it happened. Ethnographers shrink themselves in the field, but enlarge themselves on the page because first-person accounts convey experience, and experience, authority. But first-person narration is not the only technique available to us. In fact, it may be the least well-suited vehicle for capturing the essence of a social world because the I filters all. With first-person narration, the subjects and the author are each always held in view,